the words to the chalice lighting are in your order of service. Let us say together, life is a gift for which we are grateful. We gather in community to celebrate the glories and the mysteries of this great gift. For our story, I decided to use one I wrote myself called The Perfect Club. There was a boy named Mark, and he was feeling lonely. This isn't any Mark you might know. It's a Mark who only lives in my story. In my story, Mark was lonely because he did not get to spend enough time with other kids. There were other kids in his neighborhood, like Molly and Timmy and Haley and Daniel and Kelsey, but they never seemed to get together. So Mark decided to form a club. A club is a bunch of people who hang out together and do things together and have fun together, and then they're not so lonely. So Mark called up Molly and Timmy and Haley and Daniel and invited them to his house. He did not invite Kelsey, because once she gave a party and she forgot to invite him. Later, she said she was sorry, but Mark was not going to forgive her for that. But the other kids came over. Mark told them we should really have a club. In fact, it should be a perfect club. That's what we'll call it, the perfect club. That sounds good, said Haley. Sure, said Timmy. Only how do you have a perfect club? Oh, said Mark, that's easy. Everybody just has to do everything just right. As long as we're all perfect, our perfect club will be a perfect club, and we can hang out together and do things together just right and have fun together all the time. Like now, we could play some video games on my computer. And that went great. Except that after a while, Daniel was playing a hard game, and he got really frustrated and angry, and he sort of hit the computer. Not real hard, but he did. And after that, he calmed down. He felt bad. He said he was sorry. But Mark said he was out of the perfect club and he would have to leave. So Daniel went across the street to Kelsey's house. You remember Kelsey? Yeah, she isn't in the club because she once forgot an invitation. But she was home, and it turned out she had some pretty cool computer games too, and she and Daniel started playing them together. Meanwhile, back at Mark's house, the perfect club was having fun too. Except that when Haley made a silly mistake, Molly laughed and called her stupid. When Molly saw that she'd hurt Haley's feelings, she felt bad and said she was sorry. But Mark said she was out of the perfect club and would have to leave. So she went across the street to Kelsey's house. Meanwhile, at Mark's house, Haley said it wasn't her fault that she'd made a mistake in the first place. It was because Mark's computer was old and stupid. But when she heard her words, they sounded so mean, she felt bad. Said she was sorry, but, well, you know the rest. Haley ended up at Kelsey's house, too. The perfect club was getting pretty small. There was Mark, who founded it, and Timmy. But Timmy was still glad to be part of the club because it meant he got to play computer games, which he didn't get to do at home. And he played, and he played, and he played, and he played. And so Mark said maybe it was time to share. And Timmy said, yeah, in a minute. And he went on playing and playing and playing. Mark did not want to lose the only other member of the perfect club, so he tried real hard not to notice that Timmy was not sharing. But then Timmy made it a good score, and he threw up his hands and hit Mark in the eye. Of course, Timmy felt bad and said he was sorry. But Mark said he was out of the perfect club and he'd have to leave. So Timmy did. He went across the street to Kelsey's house because he could hear a bunch of his friends having fun over there. At last, all the people who weren't perfect were out of the perfect club and only Mark was in it. The trouble was, now he was lonely again like before he started the club. But he was smart. He was. He realized that he was alone because he didn't always do the right thing either. Every time somebody messed up, he had not been kind or understanding, patient or forgiving, he realized he didn't belong in the perfect club himself. So he went across the street to Kelsey's house and said he was sorry. And Timmy, Haley, Daniel, Molly, and Kelsey, they forgave him right away. After that, they formed another club. It wasn't perfect because none of them were perfect, but it was a very nice club. They always said sorry when they messed up and they always forgave each other. They hung out together and had fun together, and best of all, they were never lonely.
Thank you.
Well, that was just wonderful. And I got to hear it over and over because I was here while they were rehearsing. Wow. A few short readings, first by a man named Dick Bolster, who was a member of my church in Wayland, called Randomness, a poem. If everything, everywhere, at all times, occurred in orderly, predictable patterns, the world would be a dull place, and life would be boring. The joy aspect of the Holy Spirit will not allow this, but demands that orderliness be balanced with surprise, with unpredictability, with randomness. This balance is what makes the world an exciting place and makes life interesting. From the viewpoint of an individual or a group of individuals, the results of randomness can be unpleasant, upsetting, even disastrous, but if it were not so, it would not be random. Okay. Hans Pagels, the scientist, late scientist, who in the course of the Cosmic Code tosses in this line, which will occur in the sermon too, when events are random and independent, the distribution is stable. We'll get back to that. There seem to be two kinds of people in this world who, in their extreme forms, are those who see everything in the world as caused and meaningful, and those who believe that God plays dice and that truly random occurrences happen. The determinists find it difficult to accept the random nature of some events because their minds are repelled by chaos, by the uncaused. Indeed, the natural instinct of most people is to seek security in determinism and to find reasons for why things happen, no matter how far-fetched the reason may be. Nothing brings out the distinction between the determinist and the a-causalist so much as the confrontation with serious illness in another person or even oneself. The determinist will seek meaning and a cause for the illness. Somehow the person has brought this on himself or herself. In fact, the illness may have no cause at all, and like a radioactive atomic decay, it just happens. Harold Kushner. Let me suggest that the bad things that happen to us in our lives do not have a meaning when they happen to us. They do not happen for any good reason, which would cause us to accept them willingly. But we can give them a meaning. We can redeem these tragedies from senselessness by imposing meaning on them. The question we should be asking is not, why did this happen to me? What did I do to deserve this? That is really an unanswerable, pointless question. A better question would be, now that this has happened to me, what am I going to do about it? So I told Dee Dee that that's the readings I do. I was listening to the radio yesterday afternoon, and Radiolab, some of you may, was doing a show on fate. Oh, goodness. I'm doing a sermon on fate. It included Paul Auster, who I didn't know much of, so I went online and looked around to see what he had to say. He on the show had said things like, anything can happen at any moment. Asked if there's a string that runs through the world, he'd said, there's no pattern, no how, no way. Stories can only be told backwards. You cannot predict. So I found this interview in which he said, chance is clearly a big element in everyone's life. It's not the only element. We have free will. We can decide what we want to do. We can make choices. We can have ambitions and goals and strive to get from A to B to C to D and know that it's going to have to study hard, 8 years to become a doctor, hard work. But then often as you're on your road, whichever road you pick, something happens. What are people like, and how do we get that way? I am referring to the classic debate, usually described as nature versus nurture. Do we become the people we are because of our upbringing, our schooling, social support or lack thereof, or are we born that way, whatever way that is? These differing perspectives played a role in the arguments within the Standing Order of Massachusetts Congregational Churches in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, churches like yours and mine. Conservatives, who dominated the western part of the state, held to the traditional Calvinist view that we are largely determined by nature, our characters and our fates pre-selected by God. And the nature of that human nature to them was none too pretty. Here in eastern Massachusetts, that view is ever increasingly replaced by the notion that character is not predetermined, but susceptible to development, subject to environmental influences, including one's own efforts at what Emerson and others would come to call self-culture. So at that point, the choice is more than nature versus nurture. There's will as well that determines our fates, and I have always thought that there needed to be a fourth, the powerful influence of chance. I know there are people who think otherwise, who disbelieve in randomness, who say there are no such things as accidents or mere coincidence, but I believe accidents and mere coincidence abound, and many things happen for no good reason. I could be wrong, of course, but I find that the world is wondrously random, a goodly source of fascination and confusion, fun and ordeal, with implications for the making of faith. In speaking of randomness, I'm not disavowing the other three influences I named. Genetics, established predispositions, social setting matters as we grow up and as we live together, and I believe in the power of will in human becoming, the degree to which we are not determined, but to some degree self-creating by the choices we make. But back to fundamental randomness of life? Really? Some things just happen for no reason at all? Well, yes. Even Sigmund Freud, deterministic as he could be, knew that the beginning of maturity, not of great wisdom, but just growing up, is a recognition that many things just happen. For children, for everything there is a why, and they want to learn it. It was in our hymn, children ask the reason why. Only with time do they come to know that the answer often is just, that's the way things are, signifying nothing. Not everything is random. We count on that. Driving along the highway at 65 miles an hour, surrounded by other cars and by trucks, doing the same. Now, at a subatomic level, everything is random. But even though it's theoretically possible, I'm pretty confident the sun will not take tomorrow off, nor that this pulpit will levitate. Yes, some results are not random. There are things that do not just happen who knows why, but some things do just happen who knows why, even when it seems there is a pattern. We may see pattern when it isn't there. We'll get back to that. And perversely, one pattern that does exist is powerful precisely because randomness is powerful. There is an underlying orderliness to unpredictability. Some of you know the Monty Hall problem. Others of you have never heard of the man, which is nothing of which to be ashamed. It has been 23 years since he hosted the show on television, Let's Make a Deal, as he did for 23 years before that. The show was known primarily for two things: the outrageous costumes that audience members would wear, hoping to get selected as a contestant by Monty, and the frenzied response of contestants to any good fortune. But that is not the Monty Hall problem. The problem, also known as Monty's Dilemma or the Monty Hall Paradox, is one that was named in 1976, but came up for national attention years later after a column in Parade magazine. The column was written by Marilyn Vos Savant, identified at the time in the Guinness Book of World Records as the person with the highest IQ in the world, 228. She presented a puzzle for her readers based on the show, Let's Make a Deal. What would happen on the show was contestants had to select between three doors, behind each of which was a prize, often one a valuable prize and two substantially less so. For instance, in Ms. Von Savant's example, a car and two goats. So this is sometimes known as Marilyn's goats problem. Picture, one, two, three. Up on the stage, there are three doors. The excitement of the show would build after the choice of a door. Let's say the person picks this one over here. But before opening the door, Mr. Hall would offer alternatives. For instance, some surefire thing like money. Instead of that still unknown prize behind that door. Maybe more valuable, but maybe not. Who knows? One of the choices that Hall might offer was the one Ms. Von Boss Savant focused on. The chance to change your choice of door once another door is open and behind it stands a goat. Let's say you pick door one. As he would often do to build up excitement and complicate things, Hall would then open door three, revealing a goat. And Hall would ask if you want to change your choice. Do you want to stick with door one or switch to door two? He gave that choice. Is it to your advantage to switch? Yeah. But that's what she said, too. Ms. La Savant said, switch. About 10,000 people wrote her, the great majority disagreeing with the person with the world's highest IQ. You can imagine why. Just look. There are two doors remaining. Nothing has changed behind either of them since the outset, so they remain equally likely, like before. It's like a 50-50 bet, right? Switching makes no difference. Ah, that's what a lot of experts thought. And they not just told her, but used the occasion to bemoan the national crisis in mathematics education. They wrote things like, and I quote, "You blew it. As a professional mathematician, I am very concerned with the general public's lack of mathematical skills. Please help by confessing your error and in the future, be more careful." Another wrote, "Our math department had a good, self-righteous laugh at your expense." If there are lessons to be drawn from this morning's sermon, the first might be hesitant about correcting others, especially in certain tones of voice. You know what is coming. The experts were wrong. Ms. Von Savant was right. The professor who urged her to be more careful in the future wrote another letter telling her he was removing his foot from his mouth and eating humble pie. It's been an intense professional embarrassment. That Ms. Von Savant was right, Monty Hall could have told them all along after hosting thousands of shows. Still, he was not surprised by the experts' false conclusion. It was one he saw contestants make over and again. He would show the goat behind door three, the other there, and then offer them money instead of the door they selected over here. But they'd think their odds just went up. It was 1 in 3 before, now it's 1 in 2. I'm not going to take that. And they turned down money to offer more and more. A good thing had happened. No matter how much I offered, they turned them down. But Hall himself knew they were wrong. Nothing had changed behind the doors, indeed. So the chance of the picked door being right was still 1 in 3. And since the only other place the car could be was behind door two, the odds on that must be 2 to 1. So it doubles your chances of getting the car by switching your pick. It does. That may not seem intuitively true. One professor who knew the right answer, but sympathized with his errant cohorts, acknowledged in their defense that my reaction has been wrong time after time on similar problems. Our brains are just not wired to do probability problems well. But you can take 3 cards, like an ace and 2 twos, and play around all afternoon and provide your own answers to the Monty Hall problem, but it will be the same. Switch cards. It may not prove true at first, because we are talking odds, and in the fundamental chanciness of life, counter choices may pay off for a while, but over time, that very chanciness will obey its own laws, and with time, it will be clearer and clearer what those laws command, which is that about twice as often, switching will be preferable. Not because God favors the fickle, but because of the all-powerful, meaningless laws of probability, of chance, which declare that the sum of random independent events is a stable distribution, just like Pagel said. If you flip coins, over time, the results will tend toward equality, although each flip will be unpredictable. As someone told me after the first service, coins don't have a memory. This is about the most basic fact of life, like evolution or gravity. You can prove it before the day is over with a simple, reliable method. Take a coin and flip it over and over and watch as the universe reveals a central mystery. Every new toss is utterly unpredictable, random. But the cumulative percentage of heads and tails has a tendency toward 50-50. So unless someone is cheating and switching cars and goats behind the scene, if distribution is independent and random, if Monty shows where one goat is because he knows, you double your chances of the car by switching. The world is orderly, not because it is meaningful, but because it is not. The world is orderly because of what Pagels calls the randomness at the foundation of the material world. And so this is lesson two. One thing you can count on in life is chance. Einstein protested the notion of a universe of odds, issuing his famous statement that God does not play dice. Einstein was a brilliant physicist, but a less able theologian than Monty Hall. God, or the cosmic code, or however you describe the ultimate nature of reality, does not decree particular outcomes any more than God intercedes to tinker with the fundamental laws of creation. God or life or what have you will only provide that the laws of probability will tend to prevail. Perverse in the short run, but powerful and persistent, randomness will out, despite the appearance sometimes of some unrandom order. The other day, I watched a recent lecture by Tom Gilovich, who is still making some of the same points he was in the very popular book he wrote some time ago called How We Know What Isn't So, The Fallibility of Human Reason in Everyday Life. His big point is we see pattern when there is only randomness. To quote, we are predisposed to see order and pattern and meaning in the world. We find randomness, chaos, meaninglessness, unsatisfying. Human nature abhors the lack of predictability and the absence of meaning, and as a consequence, we tend to see order where there is none, and we spot meaningful patterns where only the vagaries of chance are operating. Examples abound. Many of us, especially those who have been through the experience, know several theories to explain why it is that couples who have not been able to conceive a child do so after they adopt. It takes a statistician to point out that there is, in fact, no rate of conception for parents who have just adopted different than for anyone else of their age. A certain number of parents will first conceive at any age, whether they have adopted or not. The theories that find meaning and pattern in what is not there. Surveys show nurses believe more babies are born, many, are born when there is a full moon. Being on the floor, they are sensitive to the truth of this bit of folklore. Unfortunately, birth records themselves demonstrate that no such connection exists. People have a tendency to notice events that support their theories and ignore competing facts to perceive order and pattern even when there is none. One problem is, as Gilovich puts it, randomness doesn't look random. There's too much clumping, which most people believe randomness precludes when in fact it requires it. John Allen Paulos wrote, most people don't realize that random events generally can seem quite ordered. In fact, one of the easiest ways of telling whether a sequence of X's and O's is random is whether it contains fairly large strings of X's and O's in a row, as chance would predict, but many people think wouldn't. I think this has religious import, because it relates to the way we understand life at its most fundamental. Several writers note the antagonism toward probabilistic views of nature and human affairs on the part of fundamentalists of every tradition, who prefer to imagine that events express God's will, not the laws of chance, and consequently that they have inherent meaning. But much, or all, of what we might see as divine providence, or the power of occult forces, or whatever, is the invisible hand of chance. And when we see the degree to which randomness rules, it is then that Harold Kushner's point has special importance. For when we see that many events do not have inherent meaning, or intention, or purpose, we can sense our freedom and our responsibility. At sometimes to delight in the quirkiness of life as it unfolds, and when the stakes are higher, when hurt and healing hang in the balance, when oppression and justice compete for control, we exercise our will and choose to give events meaning, to redeem them from senselessness by imposing meaning on them, by making them the occasion for our bravery and growth and compassion. In a Monty Hall world of choice and chance, may the roads we choose be wise and caring, and our selections perceptive and bold. firmer, kinder, simpler, and more understanding may we be this day, this week, and ever. Go in peace. The words of the sun benediction are in the order of service.